Oh, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRT-LP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. We live online at kdrt.org. I'm Bill Buchanan. Thank you for tuning in today. Well, have you ever heard of Monticello, the Northern California Monticello? It was a small town that existed west of Winters until about 65 years ago, when it was destroyed and flooded to make room for Lake Berryessa. That's the reservoir west of here, created by the construction of Monticello Dam in the 1950s. Well, the Winters Museum has made Monticello the subject of its current exhibit. And here today to tell the story of this vanished town and the people who lived there are Carol Fitzpatrick and Woody Friday. Carol's family lived in Monticello, and Woody is the president of the Historical Society of Winters and also a former mayor of Winters. So, Woody, Carol, thank you both for appearing on Davisville today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's start. Tell us about Monticello, how big it was, where it was, why it existed. Woody, you want to start?
Well, the town was formed in 1862, and this was after the Berryessa brothers had lost the land grant that they had. They got it in about 1842, and they raised cattle there. They were both in the Mexican-American Army in San Francisco, and then took up their father's rancho in this Berryessa Valley, eventually called Berryessa. Their name was Berryessa. They began to enjoy having horse races there, and little by little, they lost their land because they were paying off debts for bad bets on their horses.
So they were having horse races and losing in their own races, and they gradually lost their land that way?
You know, they would make bets on, you know, which horse would win, I suppose, and little by little they started losing land, mm-hmm. and to pay off their debts, they started selling off their land, and by 1862 they had lost all of it, and an investor came in and bought a sizable amount of the land, filed for a plat map, and called it Monticello. Why it's called Monticello, we're not sure, but Monticello in Italian, I believe, means little mountain or little hill. And there was a little hill right there in the middle of the valley. And so perhaps it was in honor of Thomas Jefferson, at the time was only 30 years after his death. So he was a popular president, and maybe it was named after that. But nobody's really sure why it was called Monticello.
You know, I'm taken by the idea that one reason the town exists is because the Berryessa brothers were bad at betting horses, and so that brought in enough people to create a town. That's quite a reason to start a place. You know?
Well, once the land got plat maps, then people who wanted to have a farm began to come in. The soil was probably the best in Northern California, and they raised pears, mostly hay, for the cattle, and they raised cattle because they were mining in Knoxville. They were mining quicksilver, and
And that's not one of those little towns up there in sort of the, right. I think of it as the Berryessa Hills. That's probably not really what it's called. So, Carol, your family was one of the founding families of Monticello?
Yeah, my family came and homesteaded on the north end of the valley, and then eventually bought a ranch in the valley when it was they were able to buy property there, and then built a house in the town.
And about 250 people, I think, was that the population I've read?
That was like during the end, and I look back at the population, and it was a lot higher when they needed people for the ranching and the farming and the mine. You know, there was a lot of people that lived on these ranches.
So it was larger than 250 then at one point. It was
yes, the town itself. No, I mean it was a small town, but the outskirts and the ranches and in the hills and up Knoxville area, there was a lot of people living there.
So you know, most towns have one or two defining characteristics. If I would take it from your answers that really was agriculture, maybe a little bit of mining was. But is there anything else about the town that basically set Monticello apart that you know made it Monticello?
Well, the rodeo was a big draw. Starting around 1920, they had one of the biggest rodeos in Northern California. In fact, they were the first town to have professional rodeo riders, and people would come from all over the place. They would have thousands of people that would show up, and they would start by having a big bonfire the night before, and bury sides of beef and cook them overnight, and cook huge kettles of beans, and that was a big draw. They would start off with a parade, and then they would have different events and like gunny sack races and things like that to get people involved. And then the rodeo would start, and it was a very big deal. You know, people from Winters remember going up there and seeing the rodeo.
Well, I guess Monticello's misfortune was its location in the end, though, right? Because the state wanted to come in. And there had been proposals. I mean, the dam was built starting in the 1950s. But as I understand it, there were proposals to put a dam there long before that, right? There had been some discussion for a long, long time.
Yes.
I don't imagine Monticello wanted the dam to go in. How did this resolve? Was it a case where the state just basically came in and said, look, that's just too good a location. We're taking the land. You're going to have to move?
Governor Edmund Brown was quoted as saying, there's 30,000 people coming into the state every month, and not one of them brings a gallon of water. And that was his rationale. It's like the water, we need more and more water for all of the people that are coming into California. And in the end, the argument that it would provide a greater good to a greater number of people than the harm that it would cause for a few won the argument. And the people from Monticello fought really hard. They put together a pamphlet and went back to Washington. And we have copies of that pamphlet, by the way.
At the museum exhibit.
At the museum. And it has beautiful photos of all the ranches and activities that were going on. And even a counterproposal to the lake that was eventually built that would provide water without having to flood the entire valley.
The Governor Brown you mentioned, that's the father of Governor Jerry
right.
Brown.
Who, Edmund Brown.
Yeah, who was governor. So, Carol, you were born after the town was flooded, right?
Yes.
But of course, your family had the connection. And what was it like? What stories have you heard, particularly when the town knew it was doomed and that the lake was going to come in?
Well, the stories that I heard from my family and the old timers that I've spoken to was, of course, they just thought that would never happen. You know, just like the resorts, you know, up at the lake, they just thought this isn't going to happen. They can't do that. They can't like flood mm-hmm. our town, you know. So yeah, they fought it, and they also, you know, told stories that, oh yeah, if they put in a lake, yeah, then we'll have more water. But they didn't really realize it was going to like encompass the whole valley. You know, just thinking of it as a small lake. You know, maybe we'll just move up a little farther onto the, you know, the edges. But
well, you know, it must have been hard to think that this town where you live is really going to be destroyed. But I guess it finally dawned the last two or three years then, did people just sort of move out? Did the town gradually just sort of lose population? And
yeah, they started moving out. The government started, you know, buying people's ranches, and some of them wanted to fight, and then they're saying, well, if you fight, you know, then you may not get anything, you know, you might get less. But so the people that did have money and wanted to fight for more money did get that. So they, you know, they took piece by piece and just started taking the town apart, and then the last thing that went down was the store.
Yeah. Yeah, and you have some photos of that in the exhibit, I think. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Of it actually being dismantled and burned.
Right. So, you know, famous photographer Dorothy Lange, famous for the Depression era photos, and later she did a series on Japanese that were interned. She was asked by Life magazine, she was paid $1,000 to come up and document the destruction of the town. In fact, she was initially going to do it with Ansel Adams, and Ansel Adams was busy with another project, so he wasn't able to participate in that. But she asked a younger photographer at the time, his name was Perkle Jones, and the two of them went up, and they spent nearly a year in 1955 and 1956 going up and meeting people on weekends or, you know, coming up for a day or two and then going back and coming back. They got to know some of the people, and they allowed them, you know, kind of into their lives a bit, and they took 2,000 photographs, and it's a remarkable, very dramatic study of the people in a period where they know that their town is going to be destroyed. And for some reason, Life magazine never published that piece. And maybe they thought it, you know, I'm just speculating, but maybe they thought it was too dark or morose for Life magazine. It did appear, or a number of the photographs did appear in more artistic magazines like Aperture magazine in San Francisco, and then some other smaller publications were put out. We have a copy of a few of the magazines that the photographs did come out. But we did get the rights from UC Santa Cruz to publish photos. They have them scanned, and we printed a number of them. And some of them may be first time ever printed because they had digital scans of the negatives.
So that's something that people can, because of those photos, they can see some of those at the museum, right? And,
yes.
And really get a feel for.
Yeah, we have about 30 photos from that collection.
Well, one thing that struck me, I was at the museum a couple weeks ago looking at this, is how in preparing the area for the lake, they took out everything.
Right?
They didn't want trees or buildings or anything, and I guess this is how you build a reservoir. But so the net effect is that the town site is entirely gone except for there's a bridge, right, that was over.
Right. Well, there's two bridges. One that was a later bridge that's closer to the north side, and it's appeared a couple of times when the lake has been really low. And then there's the famous three-arch rock bridge, which when it was built around 1900 was the longest arched rock bridge west of the Mississippi. And it spans, I think, about 250 feet. And it's a magnificent structure. It's still down there, but it's probably at least 100 feet below the
Normal water line. Mm-hmm. And that was over Poudre Creek?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to do a quick station ID. We are talking about the vanished town of Monticello. The town site is under Lake Berryessa most of the time. Occasionally it comes out during droughts. We're talking with Woody Friday, who is the president of the Winters Historical Society, and Carol Fitzpatrick, whose family grew up in Monticello. Carol, you were saying that the town of Spanish Flat was sort of meant to be a replacement for Monticello. Could you tell us about that?
Well, so when they were moving homes out, they moved 7 homes up to the Spanish Flat area because there was no, like, area for people to live or maintain the roads. No place for, they had to have a place for a school, gas station. So they moved 7 homes, and one of them was my grandfather's house. And they also moved the cemetery right there on the Loop Road. And it's right near where one of the Berryesses actually lived their life out. There's a structure still left there with some rocks. And they put in, like I said, the gas stations, the store, the school, the county yard, the post office. They brought the original post office front and put it up there at Spanish Flat.
How much did the people who lived in Monticello accept Spanish Flat as a replacement?
Well, there was just the few that got to move there and work. You know, all the rest, they all got scattered. I mean, people lost touch with their friends or relatives.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is, did they want to stay? In other words, was Spanish Flat sort of an acceptable replacement to some extent for Monticello, or was it more like, no, destroyed our town, we don't want this?
Right. That's pretty much how it was. I mean, it was a place for some of us to go. But the majority, they had to go outside, you know, go to Woodland, Arbuckle, you know, Napa areas to get land, you know, to replace what they had.
And we should mention Monticello still is in Napa County. You know, the way the county borders go up there, I have always thought of it as sort of, you know, Greater Yolo County, but it isn't. It's Napa County.
Mm-hmm.
You lived in Spanish Flat afterwards,
yes.
So you did stay. So people came to your house, I think you were saying, because it was one of the houses that was moved up out of there, and you would hear stories. I'm wondering if there's a particular story or two that you recall hearing about Monticello that you find interesting to tell?
Well, there's a lot of stories, but so my grandfather, he was born and lived there till he was 77. So he lived there with us in the house, and so people would come up and share stories. And as I was growing up, I was like, I thought of this as 100 years ago. This couldn't have been, you know, I was born 3 years later. My sister and brother both lived in the valley. My brother was in one of the Perkle Jones photos with my grandfather. They did a whole photo shoot of moving our house. And it bothered him his whole life that he lost, you know, that his grandfather and his parents lost their land, lost their ranches, lost, you know, their way of living. And this all changed.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Yeah, in fact, in one of the photos, right, I think it shows your brother and maybe your father looking under the house as it's getting lifted to move or something.
This is my grandfather.
Your grandfather.
Yes. Oh.
Have you heard any particular stories in putting the exhibit together or just in your own?
Well, Murray Clark is a real cleric character. He's still alive, lives in Red Bluff. He came down to the grand opening and he told a few stories. He talked about... times when they would just do about anything they could be man enough to do. You know, they would rig a car so that it was riding across the valley, and they were on top of the car operating it. And
that's mean the car is moving, but no one's sitting in the driver's seat,
right,
so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
that sounds like that could end badly.
Yeah. you know, Carol has, I think, one of the best stories that I've ever heard. They were opening, so Carol started the Berryessa exhibit that was in Spanish Flat. Little by little, she would hear stories from all of these old-timers. They would come up, and particularly on Memorial Day, is that right?
Yes.
And go to the relocated cemetery. And then they would have a big picnic, and they'd bring pictures. They would tell stories. And little by little, Carol says, you know, we need to save these photos. We need to save these stories. And they put together the exhibit, which unfortunately was shut down about 2 or 3 years ago because of the LN4 fire.
Yeah, so just to picture it, you had like a display there in Spanish Flat, but then the fire's coming close,
right,
so you had to clear all that out.
Right, and so we kind of inherited that.
Okay.
But when they opened the exhibit, there was this... A couple that came, and they had an older man that was sitting outside, and Carol asked, well, you know, why is he sitting out there? And the woman said, well, he's blind, and he really, you know, he wouldn't be able to enjoy the exhibit. And so she went out and talked to him. And Carol, could you tell the story? It just...
So it just started out with my mother. You know, she grew up in Monticello, and she always... told me the story how she almost drowned in Pewter Creek. And she said that somebody saved her, you know, that and then I'm like, well, who saved you, you know? And she would always, I don't know who it was, because she had snuck off to Pewter Creek to swim while her parents were at this campground, and swam out to the dock, and the dock was a little farther than normal. And she started to go under the current and everything. It was by the big rock, which is right at kind of in, towards the narrows, coming down towards where the dam is now. This is when it was the valley. And she just remembered just bobbing up and down, and the last thing she remembered was hearing the gravel and calmness, and, you know, that she was...
She thought she was dying.
Yes, and... And the next thing she remembered was, and she was, you know, not very old, probably about 7 years old. And she remembered being up on the side and coughing up water, and this man standing over her saying, well, you'll never do that again. And then so then some of the people from the campground came down to where she was at. And the man thought that she... was with her parents or whatever, so he jumped back in and swam back to the other side. And that's really all she remembered. And then later on, I guess she had... she didn't tell her parents still. I mean, she...
She was worried about getting in trouble, probably.
Trouble. And then she actually didn't tell anybody, didn't tell her parents, anybody in the valley or anything like that. So back to me being at the museum, I'm sitting next to this, he's like 86 years old, and he's on oxygen and sitting outside the museum, and he says, "Yeah, I remember being in Monticello, and we'd go up there, and I was a carpenter, and I used to go up there and go swimming." And then his wife came out, and he goes, "Oh, but he really remembers this one story." So he starts telling me that he had driven up from Vacaville and was along Pewter Creek and was out sunbathing up on a rock, and he looks down and he sees this little girl, and she's frolicking in the water, and he just sees her going under, and he's looking around, and there's nobody there, and he goes, "Like, well, I guess I'm it," and he jumps in, and he said he scratched his belly up all on the rocks, on the sand, and he just sees this black hair, and then grabs this little girl by the hair, and then drags her over to the side.
So decades later, you're meeting, almost randomly, the person who saved your mom's life when she was a girl.
I had gone years asking my mom, well, was it the Peppers that lived over there? She goes, I don't know, you know, because no one ever said anything. I go, well, maybe it was an angel, you know, because we could never put it together who saved her. And so he's telling this story, and I'm covered in goosebumps as he's telling me. And I'm like, "How old are you?" And he's like, he was telling me how old he was. And then I'm like, and I'm trying to think, you know, how in my mind, as he's telling me this story, how old was my mom? And
he told her, well, you'll never do that again.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he told you that's what he told her.
And that he said when he pulled her, because he had jumped across from one side, went to the other, pulled her up towards the campground, thinking that parents were there. And then he jumps back in and goes back to the other side because that's where he had driven up.
You know, I have to ask, was your mom still alive at this point?
Yes.
So did she got a chance to meet him?
So I'm talking to him, and he just kept saying, I'm like, "Tell me more," you know, like, because before I even said anything to him, you know, where I was going with this. And I was so excited, and he's just like over there, and he just kept saying, I'm just an old man. I can't remember much. I go, "No, you're telling me a lot here." And so then I just jumped up and I grabbed him and I go, "You are the reason I am still here. You know, I would not have been born if it wasn't for you." And he's like, he didn't know really what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then...
Was your mom there at the time?
So I got on the phone with her and I called her and I'm telling her, and she's like, I go, "Can you remember anything else, you know?" And she just goes, "Well, I just remembered that he just jumped in and went to the other side, and I never knew who it was."
Yeah.
And then I started the age, you know, it was perfect. And she remembered how old that he was, you know, and it all lined up. And like a week later, I called him and I got his wife on the phone, and I'm like, you know, is Frank still there? And, you know, can I talk to him? And she's like, "Yeah." And I talked to him a few times on the phone, and then I was trying to set up a meeting where we could get together.
We have just a few minutes left, but I really want to know, did they meet finally?
So I called because we were going to, like, get together at the Kachina up there and have this, like, this meeting. And I called, and he died.
Oh.
He died, like, 2 weeks later after I met him.
But he met you.
Met me.
And so through you.
You met him.
Connected back, yeah. That's quite a story. And, you know, that's how we like to think of small towns too, isn't it? You know, where there's that connection and it's over time. That's part of what was lost. I've had this idea as I've thought about this, that one way I think that people can identify with the Monticello story is that in some respects we all lose our hometowns, you know, as we grow older. Not this way, not being under a lake, but to time, you know, the people we knew change. Towns change, suburbs become cities, small towns vanish. And I think it's one way people can relate to a story like this. You know, a good town will have those kinds of connections like you just described there, mm-hmm. that moment. Woody, I did want to ask that you, I think you would tell me the Historical Society is just a few years old. Why do an exhibit right now about Monticello? You could do it any time. I wonder if there was a reason for doing it in the spring of 2022.
Well, so we've been in existence for about 4.5 years. This is our sixth exhibit. We started out by just collecting photos, and we didn't really have any place to show them, so we'd frame them and put them in restaurants or galleries in town and rotate them around. So we we called ourselves the Museum Without Walls. And we realized, though, that little by little, things were, you know, people would say, oh, yeah, yeah, I used to have one of those, but we gave it away or threw it away or sold it or whatever. That we weren't going to collect the kinds of things that a museum has unless we had a place to put it. So Charlie Wallace, who used to own the Express.
Yeah, the Winners Express newspaper.
He had some extra room after they moved the newspaper now to Davis. And he's got a collection of odds and ends that go way back. And so we kind of put together a museum. So why now? As I mentioned, the fire destroyed or almost destroyed the building where their collection was. And I knew Carol because we'd been doing a little research. I'd been interested in this idea of Monticello and a town that used to exist right near us. And we've done some interviews up there. We interviewed Janice McKenzie, who was a substitute teacher up there, and she's still alive. And Carol called and said that, you know, their museum had to close, and we had an opportunity right after we had our most recent exhibit was the lost town of lost Japanese town of Winters. And so as it was closing, I talked to the board and said, you know, we could do this Monticello exhibit now. We've got perfect opportunity with photos and artifacts, and so it was a good fit.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the Japanese exhibit that you had right before, and I thought, you know, that's another example of a lost community. And, you know, once you see the pattern here, Monticello underwater, in the case of the Japanese district in Winters, obviously that was removed and for different reasons, because of World War II, because of the internment. And, of course, before Monticello was there, you had the Native Americans. And I think it's the Bureau of Reclamation said there were like 12,500 people, they think, at least, who
That's
lived
right.
in that area before European contact, driven out by settlers, sent to missions, sickened by smallpox. There's at least 100 archaeological sites covered by the lake. I guess it gets back to this idea of, you know, how do you reconcile past and present? And, you know, maybe it's always a work in progress. This is where museums are useful, right? They help us tell these stories. All right, well, just we're at the very end. I did. How long is the exhibit going to be there?
It'll be up through July and maybe longer if we have good attendance. We tend to keep the exhibits going as long as there's interest.
Okay.
And in fact, the Japanese one went for about 2 months longer than we expected. And this we expect, it's had fabulous attendance so far.
Yeah.
It's not as good as the exhibit that Carol did up there, but I think we're getting a lot of viewership.
Yeah. Well, it is quite a story, and you've helped us today understand it a bit more. So, Woody and Carol, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
We'll mention the museum's open Thursday through Sunday.
That's right. Thursday through Sunday, 1 to 5 p.m.
Yeah. Well, Woody Friday and Carol Fitzpatrick, thank you both for joining us here in Davisville to talk about Monticello.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville on KDRT. And Davis, thanks for listening.